Hi FM, your station of choice since 2008.
Thank you for joining me again. It's Michael Bagram's Bags on Politics and Law and People in general, the business community. Just quickly, a report back from Parliament. The impeachment committee of our president has actually begun its deliberations. We have a chairperson, Mahashula Ghana, an MP, who has been quite interestingly appointed over and above the ANC, who were divided as to whether they wanted a chairman from the ANC or not. So it'll be interesting to see where we go. We look forward to some of the deliberations. The bottom line is that this is going ahead. It'll obviously turns to, at the end of that, whatever their recommendation, it turns to politics again because there will be a vote. And so we need to understand that it's still a political decision at the end of the day. So to go back to where we are, we have a wonderful guest, Mandy Trollope. Mandy is online with us. And before I actually hand over to her, I just want to quickly go through just a little synopsis of her background. And also, it should be known that I am friendly with Mandy and her husband, Sean. And I spend a lot of time with them on motorbike trips through most of the Western Cape. And they've been a delightful joinder for those various trips. So thank you to them. But Mandy was born in Cape Town, wonderful place to be born. And she went to St. Cyprian's School, also in Cape Town. After school, she studied commercial art at the Ruth Prowse School of Art and worked as a commercial artist for a printing firm for a couple of years before embarking on a backpacking adventure. This tells you a lot about the nature of the person who is more than willing to be a pillion rider on the back of a Harley Davidson on some of the most awful weather in Cape Town. In fact, in extreme heat and then extreme cold. So we have a backpacking adventurist with us. Before leaving to go backpacking and returning to the world of commercial art, she had moved into computer graphics, which had fitted in with her Ruth Prowse background at the School of Art, and computer graphics seemed to take her fancy. She'll tell us a bit about that. And she had also been working for a manufacturer of fiber optic cable in a managerial and sales position, which will also explain why she landed up eventually in her latest career, which we're going to hear a lot about. What is interesting, long before I actually knew about the internet, before I'd even heard about the internet, Mandy had opened up an internet cafe. And interestingly, it was a
Hi FM, your station of choice since 2008.
I apologize, Michael Bagram and Chai FM. I apologize. I'm not sure what went wrong with me in my office, but we seem to have been cut off. And I'm back, and I'm hoping that my guest Mandy is still with us. And Mandy, are you with us?
I'm here, Michael.
Yeah, okay, thank you. Okay, so just telling you a little bit about the Internet Cafe, which you're going to tell us a bit about. And I look forward to hearing about that internet cafe. I didn't know what it was at the time, so you were certainly above what was far beyond my understanding at all. And then eventually, after the internet cafe, her husband and her, Sean, opened up a company, ISE, which they'll tell me a bit about. I know Mandy runs the finance and the administration. And they grew the company into a Wi-Fi distribution company with emphasis on hospitality and education. And I'm very interested to hear about the work that you did with the education department in the Western Cape. That's interesting. The bottom line is Mandy and Sean, husband, are still running that company. They are at the forefront of internet and the schooling and hospitality. I know that they involved with quite a few hotels as well. And Mandy, let's go backwards first. Just take us through from your early days at St. Cyprian and your experiences there and St. Cyprian School and then Ruth Prowse.
Thanks, Bags. Thanks for inviting me to join. Yeah, Bags and Sips is an absolutely lovely school to have gone to. It was very, very small then. I think we had 300 kids from what was Sub A then to Matric. And I really enjoyed my education there. And we also had quite a lot of international students coming through St. Cyprian. So that was really, really enjoyable. And from there, as you mentioned, I went off and studied art, which I really enjoyed. But to be perfectly honest, I think it was more of an enjoyment than an extreme talent. And it didn't take long to figure out after art school that my interest was more in computers and being creative than actually being, you know, properly artistic. And so it was a very enjoyable time. And of course, my backpacking was extremely enjoyable. It was during quite a difficult time in South Africa when there were lots of sanctions against us, and we weren't always particularly welcome traveling, but it was very eye-opening to see the world from a completely different aspect as to how we were, you know, seeing it from within South Africa.
I did a bit of traveling at that time as well. And when people asked me where I was from, I used to say Australia. because of the embarrassment. I don't know if you had that sort of embarrassment about being a South African.
Well, it was also limiting in terms of being able to work. So, you know, if someone wanted to believe I was from somewhere else, I certainly didn't correct them. And I traveled mainly with Aussies and New Zealanders. So I guess it was just assumed that that was where I was from. But it was incredibly exciting times. I actually ended up in Turkey in the 80s, and it definitely wasn't, you know, a well-known tourist spot in those days. So that was also really a lot of fun and quite adventurous.
In but fact, there was a movie flighted at that stage, if you might recall.
I certainly do. Midnight Express.
That's it. And I don't know if you know that still at some airports in that neck of the woods, they've got posters up at the airport called, it says Dada is death, and they're referring to cannabis. okay,
exactly,
so you in Turkey and moving around with a group of young people is a bit dangerous.
Well, it was, and I mean, those were the days before cell phones, so if you didn't tell your parents where you were, they couldn't find out, and that was also quite useful at the time. So, yeah, coming back from that, it was a bit difficult to settle back in to a normal way of life in South Africa, and I did... As you mentioned, I did work for a packaging company for a while within the computer graphics environment. But where my interest in Wi-Fi and the internet, in fact, way before Wi-Fi, just the internet came in, was when I started working for a company called Fiber Optic Systems. And they were the only manufacturers of fiber optic in the Southern Hemisphere in those days, in fact. Very interesting company. And I opened up their Western Cape division, and that put me right square in the face of leading edge technology. And that was really, really enjoyable. And it was right at the very beginning of fiber optic as being a means, as opposed to copper, you know, for data. So I met some really, really interesting people through that, and actually met Sean, my husband, through that industry, as he comes from a technology background, completely technology background. And together, as we moved on, we started the Internet Cafe. And bear in mind, in those days, there was no Wi-Fi. Internet was, you know, a computer that was cabled in. You'd usually buy a floppy disk or pay for a floppy disk, insert that, and that's how you got your connection to the internet. So it was very rudimentary. Chat rooms looked a bit like a DOS screen. It was a black screen with white writing on it. And I used to have to give courses on how to surf the internet, whereas today you wouldn't even have to think of having to teach that. But it was actually really interesting. And what I did find quite amazing is that the age group of people who came in were completely varied. It wasn't just young people or old people. Everybody seemed to have an interest in coming in and seeing what they could find out, or seeing what this internet thing is and how to use it.
Can I put you on hold? We're going to have another 1 minute ad break, and we need to pay the bills.
Certainly.
Hi FM, 101.9 megahertz of life.
Hi, with Michael Bagram again, every Tuesday between 10 and 11. It's Bags on Politics and Life, and we have a wonderful guest, Mandy Trollope, with us. And Mandy, you were just telling us about the formation of your internet cafe. First of all, what made you think about opening up an internet cafe? Because that's mixing communication and coffee and food. An incredibly difficult job, if you like. But also explain, you've explained that you need to put, you had to dial in and all that. But just try and explain it to majority of our listeners who won't have ever heard of an internet cafe and probably wouldn't really know what it's all about. Just give us a little bit of a background to it and what made you think about it.
Well, I suppose, really, I have an interest in food and Sean has an interest in technology. So it seemed like a logical thing to do.
A good marriage,
absolutely. And bearing in mind that this was 1996, so we're going back 30 years. I think Sean definitely has a strong interest in technology. So we thought we'd give this a go. And in fact, it was a fully licensed restaurant. It wasn't just a little coffee shop. We were a fully licensed restaurant with a strong business community coming for lunch every day. We were down on the foreshore. And then the internet aspect as well. We had 6 computers. So it became very, very busy. And in fact, so busy that we had to move to bigger premises. It became a nighttime restaurant as well. So we were open from breakfast through to about 10 at night. It was really, really enjoyable. But from this, we realized that there's a bigger need for internet outside of people having to drive to you, to a restaurant. And that's where we decided that we're going to give it a go in hotels. And going to our first hotel, I signed up my first hotel, which is the Proto Hotel Wanderers in 2004. And it took a lot of convincing that they actually needed internet. And this was before Wi-Fi. So it was a little business center with one computer, and guests would go and use that computer to, whether it be, you know, booking an airline ticket or whatever they were doing.
So they would go to a special room or a little office somewhere.
Yeah, okay. We'd call it a business center. So it would be a tiny wee office that they would assign with a good chair and a desk and even a writing pad. It was sort of a transition from, you know, from a boardroom days into this little business center. And I remember when I went to the GM in 2007, 3 years after we'd put the internet into the hotel, and suggested to him that we should actually put Wi-Fi in the hotel. And he just said, no, he doesn't even understand this. Why would we want to do it? No one will ever, ever use it. And it just seems, you know, it just seems silly and disruptive for us to go and cable the whole hotel to put Wi-Fi access points in. And if you think forward from 2007 to 2026, you wouldn't even consider staying in a hotel that didn't have Wi-Fi now. It's like a bathroom en suite. It's a complete essential in a hotel. And as a result of that first hotel, within not too many years, we had 100 hotels that were all Wi-Fi.
When you say all Wi-Fi, you were contracted to do what?
So we would physically cable the hotel, physically put the access points in, but we also wrote the programs as to how the guest would connect by using their surname and room number to make sure they were actually a valid guest in the hotel. We had to have a support center because many guests didn't really know how to connect to the Wi-Fi. So we had a 24-hour call center that would handle guests. You know, a guest could phone you at 1 a.m. and say, look, I can't connect to the internet. What must I do? So it was
What actually happened then is that you became
key solution for the cabling.
Just to stop you there, that you had become an all stations. In other words, you had first, you got the contract. You then had to go and assess the connection points. You had to then put in the cabling. And then once you put in the cabling, you had to then have some sort of call center. So you were a call center team as well. And then also you probably had technicians who could go and sort out if a hotel reported that everyone's complaining they can't get the internet, you'd have to send someone around and find out what went wrong. I at one stage in my house, I couldn't get the internet in certain bedrooms. The house is a bit of a complicated house with major thick walls. And I had to get Sean to come and assess. I think he had like a machine to say, no, this room can't get it, so we have to put a, I don't know what, a transponder or whatever you call those things. Is that what you did? Tell us a little bit about how you actually tackled this exercise.
Well, it's really interesting. The first thing you start with is a physical plan, an architectural plan of a hotel, because you've really got to look at, you've got to take a look at it, because you have to cover this, you know, wireless involves a lot of wire. To you, the user, it's wireless, but to make that possible, there's a hell of a lot of cable that goes into a hotel, plus the physical hardware that sends out the signal. So you start off by looking at a plan of the hotel, and then you walk it. You actually walk every square inch of that hotel with a program on your laptop while you put sort of temporary APs up measuring. So
What's an AP?
Sorry, an access point, Michael.
We've got to understand, I'm quite tough. I'm tough, and I'm almost 70. So you've got to actually give me some leeway. Yeah. Okay.
So an actual access point, or I think many people just refer to them as Wi-Fi routers, but it's an access point. So you've got to make sure that the guy at the end of the passage in the last bedroom gets the same good experience as the person in the middle, you know, of the hotel. You've got to cover every area, the business centers. Typically, you'd like to cover the car park if it's a covered car park, if it's an underground car park. But we would go in and you actually walk every square inch and you decide what needs to be installed. What is very challenging is that they don't close a hotel for you to install it. You're working around guests, pulling cables through ceilings, drilling. It's not an easy thing to install Wi-Fi in an existing hotel, but you learn to just work with the hotel as to how to do it. And as guests became more familiar with Wi-Fi, they realized the need for it. So they also became a lot more tolerant of us being in the hotels doing this work. But of course, under the hood, there's also a lot of stuff that they don't see. You've got a server room, you've got lots of equipment. And yes, you have to offer this entire solution. You can't just offer a part of it. You've got to do everything from supporting the physical hardware, your access points and your servers, being ready to pull new cable if there's a cable break for any reason, and then actually supporting the guest who doesn't necessarily know how to use the Wi-Fi. So it naturally grew into what we'd call a turnkey solution, where you handle everything about that aspect of guest internet. And so it was very interesting. We built lovely relationships with the hotels and with the partners. And it was, as I say, nowadays you wouldn't even consider staying in a hotel that didn't offer you the opportunity. What we also used to say in those days was, if a room's got 100 hotels, you might only have, let's say, 40 or 50 devices connecting at one time, 40 laptops or 40 telephones, whereas now you would consider up to 5 devices per guest room, because person's got a laptop, they've got a cell phone, they could even have a second cell phone. They might have another device that's run
and
by.
They might have the husband trying to do business on the in the bathroom.
Absolutely,
or whatever.
Absolutely. Yeah. So you consider 5 devices per room nowadays. That would be how you would spec your Wi-Fi.
So that's an unbelievable thought, because you probably, the whole world has changed, because people used to get their. First, they used to get their news from radio. Then they got it from television. Today, television's become obsolete, and people have gone back to radio and Wi-Fi.
Absolutely.
You listen to radio more than you listen to television, and it's the statistics are telling us. But people are getting all their news through their devices.
Well, absolutely, and there's another aspect as well. At one point, the biggest growth of internet users was what we call the silver surfers. It was the more elderly people that were connecting with their children and grandchildren overseas. And that was a whole new growth market for the internet. And I'm sure you've got many, many friends who have got their children and grandkids overseas, and they will do a daily call. They'll do a daily video call.
Well, let me give you a scenario. When I was well, a child probably until about the age of 15 to 18, I suppose. We'd obviously, all our family were in England. My mom was from England, and we'd all gather around. My dad would come back from work. We'd all gather around the phone, and then he'd say, right, everyone ready, all quiet. We're going to phone England. It was a very big, exciting thing, and we were allowed to do that once every two or three days, with my dad always saying, prepare what you're going to say, because this is costing me a lot of money.
Very expensive.
All make this call every second day or every third day, and the whole family would get a chance to speak. That's all gone. That's all history.
Absolutely. I mean, now, even if your grandkids live overseas, you're growing up with them on a daily basis. You know, you're seeing the milestones, their first steps and things like that. So it's really wonderful. So it's not, you know, Wi-Fi and the internet is not just aimed at a younger demographic. It's really useful for everybody. Which is great.
So, well, of course, there's also the negativity connected to that, where kids would spend all their time playing games and interacting with others and all that sort of thing. We see that as there is some negativity to it. And of course, there's also a big move afoot now to find places where there's no Wi-Fi. There's been that whole flip side as well, where you want to go and camp somewhere where you've got no cell phone, no Wi-Fi, and you're offline. That's also become a big thing.
Yeah, I think information overload is a very real thing, and it is a good idea to detox, you know, every now and again from it. It comes down to, I guess, a parenting style or personality type. It's not a good idea to be on it all the time, but we certainly can't stop it. You know, so it's up to us to regulate it for ourselves or for our families.
Let me just jump in. Can I just jump in there? You then get into the hotels, and it becomes the biggest part of your business, and you contract with the hotels, and you're putting in these points so people can all have their devices in their rooms, in the dining room and the car park, wherever. You then look at schools. Tell me a little bit about that thought process before you went into them.
So, I mean, from a perspective of printing books, it becomes very expensive. Books go out of print. Certainly, things change. So to keep education relevant, it was very much decided by the Western Cape Education Department that schools should have Wi-Fi, which would allow teachers to teach the pupils, the learners, by way of their lessons being available on the internet. And so within Western Cape Education, they were very innovative on this. They were the only education department within South Africa that really got it right to have a province-wide approach and to not be fragmented about it. And they decided that they should start with the schools that are more marginalized, the poorer schools, not the wealthier sort of Model C type schools, but go into the rural areas, go into the more remote areas. And that's where they started. And there are about 1,400 schools in the Western Cape. And they started with those schools that had a harder time getting their books, getting their education. And we were lucky enough to win the tender to be the Wi-Fi supplier to the Western Cape Education Department. And so we went out, and nowadays we have Wi-Fi at 1,000 schools, starting with those smaller schools, starting with those more rural schools. And now pretty much almost every school in the Western Cape has been Wi-Fi'd. And the idea is that the children would bring their own device and use their own device. They wouldn't necessarily be given a computer, but they would be able to learn or do their lessons by way of connecting to the Wi-Fi. So it was very innovative and very forward-thinking of the Western Cape Education Department. And then certain schools do supply computers to the children, and they certainly still do have a computer lab for the children to go and learn in. But it allows you know, easier access to knowledge for each pupil, and allows the teacher to download lessons by way of the internet, by way of Wi-Fi. And I'd say Western Cape Education Department was very forward thinking in not only getting it done, but starting with more marginalized schools
And do you remember who the first, who you were dealing with in terms of the first provincial minister of education? Do you remember who that might have been at the time? Because that's quite forward thinking. I know they were the first province to get involved, and it might have been Helen Ziller at the time.
Helen Ziller initially was, definitely. And she was very, very pro-education. I believe she comes from an education background.
Correct.
But we actually would deal, as a distributor of Wi-Fi, we were dealing through the company that was supplier to Western Cape Education. So we would be, so the distributor is the importer into the country. We would
importer
design,
of what? Of
the physical equipment. Wi-Fi equipment, yeah.
Ah, okay.
And our full knowledge, our history and knowledge of having done hotels, so we would do the same with schools. We would visit every single school and assess what they physically needed in that school, bearing in mind that some schools are built like bunkers, other schools are prefab. A library, for example, absorbs a lot of the Wi-Fi signal. Books absorb a hell of a lot of Wi-Fi signal. So it's not a one-size-fits-all. Metal can stop Wi-Fi signals. So if it's, you know, if there's a lot of metal in a school, so each individual school had to be assessed with a man on the ground, and the Western Cape's a large area. And we would send people up and do physical physical site surveys to determine what was needed, then supply, and we would supply a plan of exactly what must go where.
But there's still some, just to butt in there, there's still some schools that use those containers for classrooms.
Absolutely.
So you would have to go inside that, because that's all metal.
All metal. And you'd have to sometimes do an outside Wi-Fi link between containers, and then allowed to go into the container. So each school is very individual, very different. And, we're just very good at that as a company. So we would go in and assess what they need and then supply that to the company that was, who actually was the integrator. So we would be the distributor. There's an integrator, and then the end user would be Western Cape Education Schools.
Okay, and also, just can I ask another question, because I'm quite doff about all this. So you then supply that school. I presume they tell you where they want the Wi-Fi to actually be active. I mean, there might be places they might not want Wi-Fi.
No, it has to be active everywhere.
It has it. So you can't stop it in certain areas.
No. They needed to be everywhere. Once you've done a school, you never go back to it. So we would make sure, and including the staff room, or including the principal's office, you know, because those are important areas where they are working. And what Western Cape Education brought to it was the online lessons, the ability for the teachers to mark and feedback over the internet. So, and also the control. You've got to control what the students can and can't be seeing. You know,
Just let me stop you, and I might be actually forward thinking, but we had an unfortunate event worldwide called COVID. Just before we go into COVID, we're going to have another ad break. Let's have a minute.
Chai FM, your station of choice since 2008.
Hi, thank you for joining in. If you haven't been with us, I'm with the wonderful guest, Mandy Trollope, who's talking to us about internet and now about internet at schools, initially with hotels and some of her background. And I, in particular, obviously was a bit backward with this whole issue. And it was the event of COVID that eventually got me to get I always had a cell phone, but I didn't have one of these smartphones, which everyone today's got. Wherever you go, you find people with smartphones. I didn't have one until obviously this event of COVID hit. And then I got forced to get one because I had to speak to people over Zoom, Microsoft Teams, and all those sort of things. I'd never heard of Zoom before COVID. In fact, the only time I was very aware of Zoom was there was an ice cream that used to be sold to me when I was 5 years old on Musenberg Beach, and it was shaped like a rocket. I don't know if anyone remembers that, but that was the Zoom that I remember. When they told me we're going to speak over Zoom, I had this vision of an ice cream with different colors and shaped like a rocket. So we get into Zoom, and Mandy, you in the business then at that point. What happens to your business?
Well, in terms of COVID and schools, thank goodness that people did have Wi-Fi and were familiar with Wi-Fi, because a lot of homeschooling happened, and it allowed for less disruption. And certainly from a business perspective, all of our meetings started happening over Zoom rather than, or Teams, as you said, rather than face-to-face meetings. And subsequently today, I don't jump in a plane and fly to Joburg for a meeting. We have a Zoom meeting, and you get that used to it that you can look someone in the eye on Zoom nowadays. You know, in the beginning, it felt strange.
Okay, but I noticed that you're staring me down at that point. But we wouldn't have this discussion without that ability.
Exactly. And, you know, one of the things that we do in our office is we have a huge screen. So if I'm having a Zoom session with 10 people, everyone's face is the same size as it would be in real life. But you can also do it on your phone. You know, so it makes it very, very adaptable. But certainly it was a good thing that Western Cape had already gone into Wi-Fi in schools by the time COVID hit, because a lot of those schools had the ability to you know, for the kids to have lessons from home, for teachers to teach, you know, from a safe environment. And certainly a school that I was involved in from a charity perspective would do half. So half the kids would come in on a Monday, Wednesday and Friday, and the other half would come in Tuesday and Thursday. And so those kids had an opportunity to learn from home, as you say, from a smart device. Even if two or three children shared one smart device, it was the ability for children to learn. So I think we're very fortunate as a world that we actually had the internet by the time COVID did hit. So it was disruptive, but not as disruptive as it could have been.
Well, talking about charity, I know a certain school in Cape Town where you had got involved very strongly, not only feeding children for breakfast every morning with my wife, Patsy, and it was an interesting exercise that, and you also helped them with their Wi-Fi, and you upgraded that school, and obviously, it raised no fees or charge from you, but they had a little computer room because not all the children had devices of their own. Tell us a bit about that exercise.
So because we felt very fortunate that the success of our business had largely been based on schools, obviously the hotels first, but also on schools, I felt it was a very good thing to give back charity-wise to the school environment. It seemed like, you know, they'd helped us, so we would go and help them. And as you mentioned, your wife, Patsy, she invited me in to join the charity 10 years ago, and it was feeding children every day before school. But every school prior to Wi-Fi, every school had a lab. And that lab is where children would go and learn about physically how to use a computer. And it wasn't even really about internet then. It was about children learning how to use a computer, because no one can make it in the world nowadays without knowledge of computers. So they had that lab, but the Wi-Fi aspect was taking it outside of the lab and Wi-Fi into the classroom. And the school that we were doing the charity at hadn't been put on the list yet to have their Wi-Fi put in. So we got involved and put Wi-Fi into the school for free. Because we felt, once again, it's a school that was very near and dear to me. Both Patsy's and my mom went to that school back in the sort of 30s or the 40s. And now it had become a school that was predominantly attended by, it's in the city bowl, but predominantly attended by township. So we felt it would be nice for those children to have this opportunity for the best possible learning experience. And the lab didn't become obsolete, but the lab then became less important because the children could learn, you know, could have the experience in their classroom. And a very big aspect of this is, of course, controlling. You don't want children downloading sort of violent content or, you know, maybe pornographic content. So that's where Western Cape Education Department completely controls what each learner can and can't see or download, because that's a question that a lot of people have asked. You know, how do you stop children, you know, maybe downloading the sort of content you wouldn't want a child to see? The parents can control it at home, but Western Cape Education completely controlled the access. Every child has their own unique username to join the internet, and it's completely controlled as to what they can and can't see. They also can't sit in class just watching music videos all day. The content is fed to them as to what they can see, and it's also age appropriate. But yeah, the charity was a completely wonderful experience. You know, the children didn't necessarily not eat at home, but by the time they had got to school, they were cold, they had been on transport for a long time, a lot of them leaving very early in the morning. So the idea of feeding a nutritionally sound meal as they sit down at first bell was just really, really good for them. And the teachers also saw it as an opportunity for everyone after the manicness of getting to school and the playground before school. They all did one task together, and that was eating, and it calmed them down completely. And then the school day would start. So it was really, it was a lovely experience to be dealing with the kids. And of course, because I was at school every day with Patsy, you know, the moment a printer went down, they'd call us. The moment they couldn't connect to someone, they'd call us. So we were kind of on call for the school, our company. But I felt it was a lovely thing to do. And as I said, we had been fortunate enough to be very successful in business, with education being a major pillar of that, and that the idea would be to give back into education as a thank you.
Well, congratulations on that. That was a full decade of that. The bottom line is that there's still many, many schools at the end of the day. I can hear Sean in the background. But the bottom line is at the end of the day that the schools are desperate for as much help as they can get. I know that even in the Western Cape, the Western Cape itself, which is probably the most functional education department in the country, is still struggling with a lot of their schools, and they're still struggling with a lot of the, call them township schools. I also know that schools who are known as, I don't know what it's called, but they're known as something to do with, they're in a special quintile. I don't know how what that is. Can you tell me, describe that, what that's all about.
Okay. So quintiles go through quintile one to quintile five. So a quintile one school would be a township school, and a quintile five school would be a school that is a very established school in an established suburb. So a quintile five would get 1/5 of the funding of a quintile one. So the
can
assumption
I put you,
being...
Just put you on hold 1 sec. We're going to have our last ad break. Thank you.
IFM 101.9 megahertz of life.
Hi, you're back with Michael Bagram and Chai FM every Tuesday morning between 10 and 11. We have our wonderful guest with us this morning, Mandy Trollope, who's taken us through the background of her career. And we're now at the situation where her company was doing wonderful work for hotels, is still doing wonderful work for hotels with the Wi-Fi and making sure that every guest has got access, and then went into schools with the Western Cape Education Department. And in fact, Mandy, you might recall, we had the provincial minister of education come to one of the schools. And in fact, the one that you were helping as a charity, David Mania came, and who praised the enormous amount of work that your company was doing, ISE. Do you recall that?
I certainly do. It was really lovely of him to come in and to see, you know, to also see what we were doing from a charity point of view, but the opportunity also to learn a little bit about our company. You know, I don't expect those people to know the names of the companies that are supplying everyone. So it was a lovely opportunity to chat to him about that. But you mentioned before that some of the schools are still really battling. And within the quintile system, the assumption is that a school in a more affluent area will have more children. And also that there'll be a good old boys or old girls network for supplying, you know, for funding. But what has often happened is you'll get a school that is traditionally a more affluent school, but has 100% attendance from township. So they get 1/5 of the funding, but they don't have the affluence to supply or to support the school in the way that it traditionally should be. So the quintile system is a little bit flawed. It's good in its concept, but it's a bit flawed because not every school should have that rating.
In fact, if I can stop you there, I remember you explaining that to the minister, who actually wasn't on the same wavelength, and this was an eye-opener for him, because he walked around with you in that school. I was present, and he walked around and you explained. If you looked at the demographic of the pupils, it was almost 100% black and township, and people who couldn't afford to effectively even feed their children for breakfast in the morning, but certainly not to go and put Wi-Fi into the school and have each kid with a laptop device, that sort of thing. And it was an eye-opener for him, if I recall.
Absolutely, absolutely. And there does need to be a revision of quintiles for that percentage of schools that are sort of mislabeled in their quintile. But for us, we were fortunate enough that was the school we were feeding in, myself and Pat. And because of that, I had the opportunity to supply their Wi-Fi before they were actually put on the list, because the quintile fives were the last of the schools to be provisioned with Wi-Fi. I would like to think that at some point they do look at that system and go, look, there can't be that many schools that are mislabeled, and to give them to reassess them. That school should probably be a quintile two, not a quintile five.
Well, you know what I will do, just to break in there, what I will do is I'll send a copy of this recording onto the Minister of Education, the National Minister of Education, Minister Siviwe Warubi. Maybe this would help a bit, but you might expect a call from the minister after listening to this program.
Yeah, I mean, we are
coming close to the end of our program, but what I do want to know, and I know that you, in your company, you're exploring a whole new internet device or internet connection, or I didn't fully understand it, but you want to share a little bit. You don't have to share the secret, but what you're trying to do, what's the outcome you're trying to do?
Yeah, Bags, what we're looking at here, and it's still very much in the beginning stages. Sean is very good at identifying new trends and seeing where things are going. So what we're looking at is how do you get people to just be easily be able to connect securely anywhere? You're walking through a shopping center like the waterfront and you want to do some banking on your phone. Are you sure that your connection is secure? Are you sure that it's a safe environment? You know, we carry all these passwords on our phone. Our lives exist on our telephones, as they are smart devices. They're hardly even phones anymore. They're cameras, they're communication devices. There are news devices. So, I'm not really at liberty to discuss too much about it. But
no, I understand.
We're looking at systems as to people be guaranteed that they can connect completely securely anywhere and everywhere, that you would only have to sign up kind of once without having to sign up every time.
Well, once you spread that out to all the shopping centers, we'll have you back on air telling us what it's all about. I know that Sean is flying around the world and talking to people, but I need to wrap up. Thank you for the most wonderful discussion we've had. I'm sorry that I don't have any knowledge about it at all, so that's why I've been stopping you and waiting for explanations. And I also apologize for the short time when my internet went down. I don't know what happened over here, but sorry about that. So thank you, Mandy Trollope. I really appreciate you being with us today and taking of your time. I really appreciate it.
Thanks for inviting me, Bags. I enjoyed it. Thanks very much.
Thank you.